Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Eileen Miles, whose new memoir is Afterglow, and Simeon Marcellus, whose new novel is As Lie Is to Grin. Novelist and memoirist Eileen Miles is the author of more than 20 books, including Chelsea Girls, Cool for You, I Must Be Living Twice, New and Selected Poems, 1975 to 2014, and now Afterglow, a dog memoir. You may know Eileen from their work from the second and third seasons of Transparent, or you may remember them from their presidential campaign in 1991 and 1992. Eileen Miles, welcome to The Reading Life.
Hey, thank you, Susan. Glad to be here.
Now, this is such a moving and intense book. It's everything about life with a dog.
And some things that are not about life.
Well, yes.
Something particular to this dog, I guess.
That's right. But dogs have been ever-present in your work, you know? Do you feel like you've come full circle since writing that poem, The Irony of the Leash?
The dog has always stood in for a whole lot in my writing and in my living as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think as a kid, I very, very badly wanted a dog, and I came from one of those families. We lived in a two-family house, and we lived upstairs, and there was a lot of space, and I couldn't have a dog, and I had one for about a second, and the dog went back. So dogs became like sort of a symbol of my longing for all sorts of things, not just dogs. So dogs held this space in my writing. Then there became a real dog, which was Rosie. So it's sort of two things. It's sort of wider than dog and then specifically dog.
Mm-hmm. Now, you knew, of course, that there were lots of dog books, and you knew that this book about your Rosie would be a different kind of dog book from the very beginning.
Well, you know, you write the dog book that coincides with the kind of writer you are. And you know, my writing is a lot about messing with forms, trying to reinvent stuff. I'm a poet, so when I turn to prose, I turn to it with a certain energy. And I've also been accused of writing memoirs a lot because I use my own name in my writing.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like I've always been writing fiction. So with this book, I claim to be writing a memoir, but indeed, I think it's probably the most fictionalized book I've ever written as well.
Well, there's a wonderful play in the middle of this book with wonderful puppets.
Yeah, yeah.
And those are actual puppets that you created.
I took all those after-school art classes when I was a kid, and puppet making was my favorite. So I've had these guys around since the 50s and have been thinking about, you know, like, maybe I should, like, shoot a video with the puppets or write a screenplay. And then at whatever point, I was at an artist colony, and I had read some of this book in progress, and people said, is Rosie going to speak? And I was just kind of sneered. I was like, is Rosie going to speak? What kind of artist colony question is that? I just thought... And then I thought, under what conditions would she speak? And I thought, well, if the puppets had a talk show and they invited her, she would sit down and tell them who she was.
Well, you give her such a life in this book and such a voice. I mean, you imagine her as your father returned to you, and that gives you a way to talk about alcoholism, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I have to say, he was there. I mean, or maybe it was just love or attachment, because when I looked into her little puppy eyes when I got her, I just felt his presence. Who knows what that means or how that works, but she was a conduit to feelings that I hadn't had access to. And so once I opened them, especially by the time she was gone and I was writing this book, I could talk about things I'd never written about, like alcoholism, like his death,
mm-hmm.
like losing a beloved parent.
The most difficult chapter for me to read in this book was the chapter about mating Rosie, and what a complicated, messy moment that was.
And that chapter is actually plucked out of an earlier point in time. I was running for president in 1990 and 91. I was a write-in candidate, and for lots of reasons. Some of them feminist, some of them queer, some of them poet. And people at the time, when they asked me, what's your platform? Why are you running for office? What I came up with was total disclosure, that I would tell you what I was really thinking, what I was really feeling, what the secrets of my life were. And one of them was the shame around the fact that I had essentially had my dog raped. You know, I mean, I just like, just to say that out loud sounds horrifying, but what is it you call it when you stud your dog and they don't really seem to want to do it? It was kind of, I mean, the horrible joke at the time was that I should be making buttons with Rosie's face on it, and it would say, I believe her.
And I've heard your acceptance speech, too. Now, that is a pretty remarkable piece of writing.
Wow. Well, thank you.
Well, yes, I think you should be out there accepting all the time.
Maybe I am. I might be.
You know, well, you talk a lot about, you said before that you don't read a poem aloud until you have an audience. And you said there's something about reading your own work alone in your own apartment that's kind of gross. And I wonder how you're feeling about that with this book, because it's such a generous, revelatory, detailed account. I mean, what is it like for you to read this as opposed to a poem? Is it more difficult? Is it the same? What?
Well, it's different. It's different for one thing, because different people come out. It's sort of like, to some extent, I'm attracting a dog audience now. And so dog people come to hear about dog, and they get my account of dog. So there's a little bit of trepidation. I'm you know, like I'm standing there reading from this book, and I'm thinking, is this a little too weird? Because, you know, I've read a lot of sci-fi and fantasy, and I've used a lot of that. So it just really is very errant dog book. But also, there really is stuff in here that's so deeply personal, maybe in ways that I've not quite been out there with. I mean, maybe more contemporary relationships, ways I feel about my body, and even talking about God. Like, I make the God-dog joke here.
Oh, yes.
But this winds up, to me, being my most spiritual book, too.
Oh, very much so. Very much so. Mm-hmm. You talk a lot about listening in this book, especially in that chapter, The Order of Drinking, where the characters of Eileen and Rosie go to an AA meeting, and they're both finding a way to be part of things. And you have to listen to Rosie, too, in your effort to become part of things. And I think that's so important right now, because we're in a time where we really need accepting listening and compassionate speech.
It's really interesting to think about how we listen. I mean, because I kind of talk for a living in a way. I feel like I make my living more giving readings than I do even writing. And I think that's the case with a lot of writers. You make a living teaching. You make a living doing readings. You usually don't make a living selling books. You know, like, you really hit the jackpot if you make a lot of money on a book. But so what you're really thinking about a lot is how people listen. And looking, and same with teaching, looking at a room full of people. It's like, what's going on? And I think a whole lot of the way I write is thinking about the fact that no matter what I'm reading and no matter what you look like, I know that you're not listening all the time. And I try and make room for that in the writing itself. I try and take into account that that people's minds wander. And so I feel like that gives me permission to wander a little bit, too. And as long as I'm bringing you home. I mean, if I keep reminding you where you are often enough, but then go where I want in the course of the writing, I think I'm doing my job. Because I think people kind of journey a lot when they're sitting there listening. You know, attention is interesting, and it's just never total. It's really a live thing, and I want to respect that thing in people. They're listening and they're not listening, and they're thinking about their lives, you know, and I want to be with them, which is to say, I want to be with them and I want to go away too.
When you read this book, are you looking for some kind of reaction? Are you curious to see what people will do?
You mean when I read it out loud?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess I'm probably looking. I mean, when I'm writing, I'm looking for a home.
Right.
So I suppose when I'm reading, I think the same thing is going on. And I think part of what we look for when we go to readings and we pick up books is we're looking for a home, I think. I think it's just like there's nothing more kind of grounding than the sound of a human voice reading to you.
I know. And, it's one of my oldest memories, you know.
Yeah. I know. Oh. I mean, it's just like it's not a fractured memory. It usually is a very kind of redolent, familial, you know, just kind of a belonging place. And so I like to write from a position of making a world where I belong, and hoping that this work is an invite to that in you.
Well, you know, you belong wherever poets are. So now I think of so many writers who have such intense connections with their dogs, and the dogs become famous. You know, Emily Dickinson and Carlo, and Virginia Woolf and Flush, and Mary Oliver and Percy and all of her dogs. And then there's that wonderful Gertrude Stein quote, "I am I because my little dog knows me." And there's this moment where you ask yourself, you say, who will I be without my dog? Or the character asks that. And I'm curious to know what surprised you about the answer you found, if anything.
Yeah, yeah. God, I think I you know, like maybe a new kind of void that I had to figure out how to be in. You know, it was one thing when I stopped smoking cigarettes, it was another thing when I stopped drinking. But losing my dog was a kind of, and you know, and I've gone through breakups with lovers and girlfriends, but to lose my dog was to really feel alone in a new way. And I guess, you know, I'm not even sure how to complete. I mean, it's just like, I think that made me write. It made me write. It's just like, in a way, the writing of the book was reconstructing the dog and bringing the dog back.
So I wonder, are there dogs in your life now that you could talk about?
There's a big golden pit bull named Honey. And she mostly lives in Marfa, and she was a stray in the Bronx. She's another city dog, and I didn't mean to get her. It was sort of, I was dogless, and I bumped into my former dog walker, and I was doing alternate parking, which is what we do in New York when you like have to sit in your car for a half hour, and then you go. It's just all about street sweeping in New York. And it's a really funny moment where people in the neighborhood meet each other a lot because you're just having to move from one side to the other so they can sweep. And we had this conversation about me being dogless, and then I was sort of seduced into being in touch with a pit bull rescue person. And I was going to take a dog for a weekend, and there was the perfect little dog. It was like a submissive little pit bull named Mindy, and I was gonna have Mindy for a weekend, and then Monday somebody was taking Mindy. And at the last moment, they said, wait, there's a dog named Honey in the city shelter, and she's beautiful, 2-year-old pit bull. She's golden. She's so full of life. And she's going to be put down at 1 o'clock because she's been in and out of the shelter twice. And so they said that if I fostered her instead, we could get her out of the shelter and we'd figure it out later. And so figuring it out later meant she's my dog.
Of course.
Yeah.
You have to have a bit of a soft heart with dogs. You do.
Yeah, they kind of happen to you in a way.
Yeah, it's a lovely thing. Oh, we've been talking with Eileen Miles, whose new book is Afterglow, a Dog Memoir. You can meet them Thursday, November 16th at 8 at the Saturn Bar, 3067 St. Claude Avenue. Eileen, thank you so much.
Susan, thank you. This has been great.
Simeon Marsalis is making a splash with his first novel, As Lie Is to Grin, which even before its official publication date was on the long list for the Center for Fiction's First Novel Prize. It's a story of a young college student finding his way in a kaleidoscopic world of mixed messages about race and identity. And yes, he's part of that great New Orleans Marsalis family, though he's making his mark with words. Simeon Marsalis, I'm so happy to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first, let's talk about the title of your book, which is taken from the Paul Laurence Dunbar poem, We Wear the Mask, which has the line, "We wear the mask that grins and lies."
Yes, this title, it's funny, it took me a long while to settle on. The development with Paul Laurence Dunbar actually is a wider theme in the book that deals with poetry and the proximity between fiction and poetry and how much we kind of borrow from each other. It was really interesting for me to find out that Gene Toomer, who is an author who composed the 1920s masterpiece, Kane, that he attended the M School in Washington, D.C., that was named after Paul Laurence Dunbar. So there were all these connections between the quote from the book and my book itself.
And there are so many masks in this book. There are the theatrical mask of minstrel shows. There are racially charged identities, the idea of passing. It's a kind of complex, fracturing vision that goes on and on through the book.
Yes, yes. In fact, you know, I tried to stick to two themes. These themes are kind of just always floating around my mind. And the first one is that the past, personal and historical, is always present.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is that, you know, race is constructed. Not only is it a human construct, but we construct it ourselves in the present. So for me, as David goes through the world, this becomes kind of this masking is on the first level, it does deal with race because Paul Laurence Dunbar's poem can be interpreted to being about African-Americans around the 1900s. But on a wider level, it asks the question of the human mask, you know, what each of us wears in public and how it is constructed. There's a scene in the book where he's reading through the newspaper and he notices that it says students can't mask their joy for Latino Heritage Month. And this is a true event that happened in the University of Vermont. And this was, all of the newspaper entries are taken from The Cynic, which is the local student newspaper between the years of 2009 and 10. And there was that moment where students are actually constructing masks for Latino heritage, and one of the students says, you know, it's a fun way to get into somebody else's culture. So masking is very, very important in this book. I'm happy you noticed that.
One of the things that comes through in this book to me that I just love is that one thing you do have in common with this main character is that you're both really astute observers of the world around you. I love the way David sees messages in the landscape. For example, I love the way he sees the Sankofa in the landscape everywhere and ponders its message, which is reach back and get it. And I wonder if you talk a little bit about the Sankofa and what it means to you.
Sankofa is interesting. My mother grew up in Fort Greene, Brooklyn, and there's a festival that goes on downtown, and there's all of these patterns, you know, this Adinkra comes back again and again in the New York landscape outside of the construction of gates. And it's a symbol I've seen for a long time, and I've always associated kind of with what we call hotepery, or the hotep, which is a kind of reaching back to Africa as a base for everything that is African-American in an untrue way. So I found it interesting to give David the Sankofa, or to see what he would interpret from it. You know, the Sankofa or Adinkra in general are the result of the Ashanti Kingdom in West Africa, what is Cote d'Ivoire now, and Ghana, present-day Ghana.
Yes.
For David, it becomes, you know, the reach back and get it, the final message when he does approach the African-American National Monument downtown is to go find his mother. So it does become this question of how knowable prior generations are.
Mm-hmm.
I guess for David, the question of the Sankofa, reach back and get it, becomes what is he getting from the past? Can he discern what is good from the past to bring to the present? And this has a lot to do with the erasure that, you know, many African-American people feel because of slavery, because of the schism, because of the transatlantic trade, which cut many generations off from a family system.
Uh-huh. Well, I was also so interested by the way you drew in the figures of the Harlem Renaissance. I love that moment when Doris says, their lost generation was our Harlem Renaissance, which I thought was such a great line.
Yeah, thank you. And I mean, that conversation happens in the scope of also Melody's family system and where they are at the time.
Yes.
And because that's not something that Melody's grandfather would have said, you know, Melody's grandfather who has removed himself from this. But I think there's a second level to it that I liked, which is that, you know, David questions this duality that's being created, whether there can be a Harlem Renaissance. Famously, actually, my grandfather is the first person to tell this joke to me, my grandfather Ellis, but he says, you know, what was it a Renaissance of? what was the nascence, you know, what was the birth? So it's more, for David, these divisions, whether Gene Toomer is in the Harlem Renaissance or if he's a true modernist, become almost rendered absurd, you know, by this question of race that that melody his grandfather presents in melody and him and his relationship to melody. So I did really enjoy writing that in there because there is, you know, when we learn about this history, there is such a stark divide. But a lot of David's, dare I say, madness comes from this constant division and this understanding of himself through division.
So you've actually written this a couple of times. You talk about how Zachary Lazar, who teaches at Tulane, helped you form it into what you call a contiguous novel. And then you wrote it again.
Yeah, so a big part for me, I think a big part of my process was not being afraid, right? There's the famous thing, don't be afraid to kill your darling.
Right.
And I may have taken that too far. because this is a very different book than the book that I set out to write. Which is not a bad thing at all. I'm very happy about it now. But I think at every step in the process, I wasn't afraid to cut or add or continue this conversation. You know, the book for me is a long conversation that's happened over 4 years. But I had this novel that I really wanted to complete. And so I had this idea to move down to New Orleans because it was smaller and I would have more time and maybe the living would be a little bit cheaper, and to complete this novel. And that kind of sparked a whole new journey that took the book in a different direction. But Zachary Lazar was a big influence on the book because when I came down here, I initially came down to New Orleans to meet Jessamyn Ward, whose book, Salvage the Bones, I had just read. And my thought was I was just going to be an apprentice, you know, this traveling artist apprentice. I was going to work another job, and that didn't end up working out. I never met Jessamyn, but I went with Lolis Eli, who's a former writer for the Times-Picayune, a good friend of my father's. He invited me to a party at Roy Blunt's house. And Zach was kind of the youngest person there, and I was really excited. I said, yeah, you know, I'm a writer. He goes, oh, I'm a writer as well. And I go, yeah, you know, but I got some really important stuff. You got to read my stuff. And Zach's like, okay, well, what do you write about? And I'm like, gentrification, you know, this is really important work. And Zach's like, okay, well, why don't you send me a story? And it turned out that he actually lived down the street from where I was on Pauger and Dauphine.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it was crazy. So I went over to his house and we spoke about the story. And I said, you think that story's good? I got this great novel. He was like, okay, I don't have time to read that thing, but this summer I will. And kind of from there, you know, I was still editing the book. And it's a joke that I told him later is that, you know, I was telling him about this great novel I had, but it wasn't finished at that point, or I had opened it back up and there were all these decisions to be made. The pictures hadn't been added in yet. And I'm not even sure we got to Paul Laurence Dunbar, so I'm not sure what the book was that I gave to Zachary Lazar at the time.
Well, it's amazing how that works sometimes. And the one thing I do find is that New Orleans is such a generous city. You know, it gives gifts like that. You make that connection, and it matters in ways you can't possibly imagine.
Yes, indeed.
So, well, it is an amazing book. We've been talking with Simeon Marcellus, whose important new novel is As Lie Is to Grin. You can meet him Friday, November 3rd at 6 at Octavia Books. Simeon, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Have a nice day.
Today marks a changing of the guard at The Reading Life. Almost 7 years ago, I first walked into the WWNO studio with Jenny Lawson, who said, "Where are your scripts?" Blissful fool that I was, I thought radio was just the product of good conversation. Jenny proceeded to instruct me about that and so many other things. How not to laugh and talk at the same time, how to say it with a smile, how to refine a question, but most of all, how to make guests feel welcome. Now she's moving on. Every writer needs a great editor, and Jenny has been that and more. I'll make it all perfect, she tells our guests and me, and that's what she's been doing all these years, and choosing witty music to boot. This show is as much her creation as mine. Along the way, she's become a confidant of the heart, a partner in crime, and this being New Orleans, we've spent a fair amount of time dusting glitter off one another. So farewell, Jenny, and thank you. Thank you for everything, but most of all, our friendship. I wish you lots of happiness in North Carolina, and welcome producer George Ingmeyer to this new chapter in The Reading Life. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Ed Branley discusses and signs Krauss, the New Orleans Value Store, Tuesday, October 31st at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Holly Murchison discusses and signs Tell Me About Yourself, 6 Steps for Accurate and Artful Self-Definition, Wednesday, November 1st at 6 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Simeon Marsalis, discusses and signs As Lie Is to Grin, Friday, November 3rd at 6 at Octavia Books. Richard Campanella discusses and signs Cityscapes of New Orleans, Thursday, November 2nd at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Lynn Farwell White discusses and signs Gifts and Giving, The Art of Thoughtful Giving, Tuesday, November 7th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Legendary journalist Bob Schieffer, former host of Face the Nation, and co-author Andrew Schwartz of the Center for Strategic and International Studies discuss their new book, Overload, Finding the Truth in Today's Deluge of News, Wednesday, November 8th at 6 at Rogers Memorial Chapel at Tulane University. Jamie Attenberg reads from her novel, All Grown Up, Thursday, November 9th at 6 at the New Orleans Public Library, Main Library. Joel Dinnerstein discusses his book, The Origins of Cool in Postwar America, with Maurice Ruffin, Thursday, November 9th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. MacArthur winner Jessamyn Ward signs her most recent novel, Sing, Unburied Sing, Saturday, November 11th at noon at Barnes & Noble Metairie. Claudia Gray signs her new young adult novel, Defy the Stars, Saturday, November 11th at 1 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. And coming up, Garden District Bookshop presents Chilean-American novelist Isabel Allende, discussing her book In the Midst of Winter with Anne Gislason, November 17th at 6 at the Academy of Sacred Heart NIMS Fine Arts Center. This is a ticketed event. Go to GardenDistrictBookshop.com for more information. Dates to mark on your calendar now. STARE, Start the Adventure in Reading, holds its annual fundraiser, The STARE Affair, November 9th. The theme this year is The Tale of Peter Rabbit. For tickets, visit starenola.org. The New Orleans Book Festival takes place Saturday, November 11th in City Park. The National World War II Museum presents the 10th Annual International Conference on World War II, November 16th through 18th at the museum, with 3 full days of internationally known writers. For more information, go to ww2conference.com. And Words and Music, a Literary Feast in New Orleans, presented by the Pirate Sally Faulkner Society, is set for December 6th through 11th, with featured guests Walter Isaacson, John Gregory Brown and Carrie Brown, Andrew Burstein and Nancy Eisenberg, and Jeff Kleinman and Deborah Grosvenor. For more information and to register, check out wordsandmusic.org. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.